Once again, the hour's top story. State Department denies reports U.S. and North Korean negotiators are making headway toward release of the Pueblo and its crew. David Rush, NBC News, Washington.
Listen again on the hour when Stuckey's Roadside Refreshment Centers bring you NBC Monitor News.
The San Francisco Story, brought to you by Jenkel Davidson Optical Company, serving all of Northern California. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bud Heide, inviting you to be the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for another half hour of the stories of San Francisco, the story-making towns and hills that surround it, and the people who made San Francisco's past so colorful. These impressions, written by Samuel Dixon, are brought to you each Sunday morning at this time by Jenkel Davidson, stylists in eyewear, with offices throughout Northern California. We hope you enjoy today's story. Does a diller, a dollar, a 10 o'clock scholar ring a bell? Of course. It's that old nursery rhyme many of us may remember from further back than we care to remember. But for today's parents, it should ring another bell as a reminder that school will be starting again in only 8 more weeks. And that means that now is the time to schedule an appointment with your medical eye doctor to have your child's eyes checked to make sure that when your scholar starts back to school, he won't be handicapped by poor vision. It's a good feeling to know your children's eyes are all right. And if they aren't, it's a good feeling, too, to know that you had them corrected before they got worse. For your child's sake, make an appointment tomorrow with your medical eye doctor, just in case his schedule is full later on. Remember, look to him for the best in eye care. Look to Jenkel Davidson for the best in eye wear. This morning, we bring you the third and final episode in the story of John Charles Fremont. We have traveled swiftly over the drama of Fremont's three expeditions to the West, of the story of his court-martial on the grounds of mutiny, of his fourth expedition to California to survey the way for a railroad across the Rockies, and of the journey of his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, to join him at the height of the gold rush in the San Francisco of 1849. And we mentioned briefly the fact that Fremont had handed Tom Larkin of Monterey $3,000 to purchase a tract of land in the Santa Cruz Mountains where the Fremont family could create a home. But for some unexplained reason, Larkin had failed them. Instead of purchasing the acres in the Coast Range, he had invested the money in a valueless, useless tract of land high in the Sierra, a place called Mariposa. The Fremonts were down to almost their last dollar, and this cruel, meaningless whim of destiny was almost unendurable. There was, of course, one vague, unfounded glimmer of hope. Gold had been discovered in the Sierra far to the north of Mariposa, and it was just possible that a remnant of that gold might be found on the Fremont land, enough to repay them for the $3,000 invested so unwisely by Larkin. So Fremont established his wife and daughter in a small home in Monterey and then made plans to visit the Mariposa. It was not a journey to be made alone, for the land was wild, and if there was gold on it, the labors of more than one man would be required. And so he gathered about him a group of Sonora Mexicans, induced them to accompany him on the expedition to the High Sierra, agreeing to give them half of any treasure taken from his land. He returned a month later, appeared before his wife, staggering under the burden of a huge, heavy bag, a bag containing more than $25,000 in gold. Of course, one half of it belonged by agreement to the Sonora Mexicans who had traveled with him and worked with him. But that didn't matter. He could well afford to give them not half but all the treasure, for the ground had not even been scratched. The Fremont's Mariposa acres were the heart of the richest gold country in all the world. And so up again went the destiny of the Fremonts. News spread like the fires that were making their inroads on San Francisco that the Sonorans were literally taking gold out of the Mariposa by the bucketful, and a new gold rush started. In no time at all, 3,000 prospectors were swarming over Fremont's land. But the land had come to him under a Mexican grant which made no provision for mineral rights, and so there was no protection against the squatters. But now bag after bag of gold was arriving to be stored in the Fremont's Monterey home. Each buckskin bag weighed 100 pounds, and each was worth in the neighborhood of $25,000. And while his Sonorans were working his land for him, and without supervision, were carefully dividing all of the gold they dug, one half for themselves, one half for Fremont, during all that time, Fremont was busying himself with politics. His fame as an explorer was now nationwide. His notoriety as the man who owned the richest gold fields in the world pyramided his fame. But above all these, John Charles Fremont had embarked on a crusade. Above all things, he detested slavery. He enlisted in the verbal and political fight against slavery and devoted his every effort to its abolition. The territory of California, won from Mexico by the United States in its recently ended war, was preparing to send two senators to Washington. And two men were elected, the one William M. Gwynne, an avowed supporter of slavery, the other slavery's enemy, John Charles Fremont. The two were elected, but a decision had to be reached as to which would hold the long term. They drew straws, and Fremont drew the short straw. Gwynne would hold the long term. Of course, the election would not become valid until California had been admitted as a state. But this was late in 1849, and the petition for statehood had already gone to Washington. And on New Year's Eve of that year, the Fremonts sailed out of California for Panama and the eastern seaboard. On the ship with them was William Gwynne, and in the hold of the ship was $3 million worth of California gold. Washington was a busy place in the spring of 1850. Fremont, waiting for the recognition of California as a state, was a man without a job. But there were rounds of social activities. Jessie Benton Fremont was adored, and her husband, reputed to be on the way to becoming one of the richest men in the world, was lionized. And on September 10th in 1850, with California as a state, John Fremont took his seat in the Senate of the United States. His program was a brilliant one. His maiden speech was received with acclaim. He had plans to expedite emigration to the West. He stood firmly square-shouldered against slavery in the West. He presented bills for the building of institutions for the blind, the dumb, and the insane, plans for a system of statewide roads and a national road to California, and bills for judicial control, bills covering land claims. And every bill he placed before the Senate was passed. He was embarking on a sensational and amazing career as a political diplomat, a career that became overnight a mockery. For Fremont had drawn the short term as United States Senator, and in 3 weeks, he was out of a job. So back to San Francisco to supervise the development of the Mariposa, he went. He bought an odd monstrosity of a house on Stockton Street above the plaza and took his place in the chaotic life of the gold-mad city. But now the hardships he had suffered in the snows during his third and fourth expeditions to the West, aggravated by fever he had contracted in crossing Panama, took toll. He was gaunt and tired, and although only 37 years old, his hair was turning from gray to white. He suffered from rheumatism, neuralgia, and constant headaches. And so Jessie came West to nurse him, and the Stockton Street home became the center of San Francisco's social life. And having established his wife and daughter, he was off to the hills again to supervise his Sonorans and to trade on the side, selling beef and other commodities to the Mariposa Indians. And during his absence, during the influx of the Sydney Ducks, convicts from New Zealand, San Francisco went through its first great fire, and the Fremont home was consumed in that fire of June of 1851. Fremont was a man of moods, reacting in unexpected and unpredictable ways to the turns of fortune. Entering the destroyed city, finding his home in ruins, he was led to the new home Jesse had built high on the hill near Grace Church. And he found her shaken by hardships, bodily ill, nerve-worn. And though things had not been going well at the Mariposa and his fortune was at a low ebb, he laid in her hands steamship tickets for a journey to Paris. They would see the world, and in Paris, incidentally, he would try to borrow enough money to permit expansion of his gold mines. Their tour of Europe was a triumphant cavalcade. In London, they were entertained by the aged Duke of Wellington. In Paris, they were introduced to society by a relative of the Bonapartes. But their funds were running low, so Fremont cashed claims running into more than $100,000 against the United States government for beef supplied to the Indians. The claims were ignored, and he was arrested in Paris for non-payment of the drafts he had drawn against the government, accrued during the days he was acting governor of the territory of California. Released on bail, he returned to Jesse just in time to greet the arrival of another daughter. So depressed one minute, his mood was again high, until word came that squatters were making inroads on his Mariposa holdings. And so back to America they came, and there fresh tragedy pursued them. The baby girl, now 4 months old, unable to endure the heat of the Washington summer, died. Heartbroken, shaken by their many trials, the Fremonts lived through months of apathy, until out of a clear blue sky came the assignment that again meant life to John Fremont. He was to travel on a fifth expedition to California, this time to survey the route of a railroad across the Rockies. But that expedition, too, was a disastrous one, for the way was lost, and the party suffered untold privations, going at one time for 48 hours without a morsel of food. That was in 1854. In 1855, while Fremont was again west, working on the Mariposa, a delegation called on his wife in Washington to tell her that the Democratic Party, cognizant of the strength of her husband, intended to place his name in nomination as President of the United States. A new party had been born in 1855, the Republican Party, but it was strongly anti-slave, and the strength of the South would defeat any Republican candidate. Fremont was asked to run on the Democratic ticket. Yes, he would run, until he learned that he would have to endorse laws supporting slavery, and then he rejected the nomination, and in the spring of 1856, he was nominated by the Republicans on an anti-slave ticket. That campaign was one of the most dismal demonstrations of muckraking in the political history of the country. The Democrats falsely accused Fremont of being addicted to strong liquor, falsely accused him of having been a slave owner, published the story of his parentage and the stigma upon it, made capital of his court-martial, of his arrest in Paris, of the failure of his Western expeditions. And so he was defeated, and Buchanan was elected president. We'll get back to our story in a moment. If you have children of school age, it might be just as well if you sent them out of the room at this point, because we're going to briefly mention the subject of school. And though it's still a couple of months off, there's no use reminding them. But we would like to remind you that now is the time to think about having your children's eyes examined in preparation for the upcoming school year. Too often, the reason children find school difficult or unpleasant is because they're slightly handicapped by a visual problem, a problem that can be simply corrected by prescription glasses. Don't let poor eyesight hold your child back in school or in life. Make regular eye examinations a part of your family's routine health program. Visit your medical eye doctor every 18 months or so, and remember, look to him for the best in eye care. Look to Jenkel Davidson for the best in eyewear. Now to the conclusion of our story. A fortune in gold was again being taken out of the Mariposa mines, and John Fremont was now said to be the richest man in California. And to the Fremont home came the leaders of San Francisco. One intimate friend was Thomas Starr King, a spirited fighter to save California from seceding from the Union. But war was in the air, inevitable. And with the firing on Fort Sumter, John Fremont once more wore the uniform of the Army of the United States. Fremont's command was the Department of the West, all of the land lying between the Mississippi and the Rockies, and his headquarters were in St. Louis. St. Louis was a hotbed, half northern, half southern in sympathy. Fremont had too few men and too few arms, and his petitions to Washington and President Lincoln brought no relief. And so he conceived an amazing plan. The war was going against the North. It was a political war, a war of factions. But he was determined to bring the main issue out into the open and make it a war against slavery. And he figured that the first step in the right direction would be the freeing of all slaves. A proclamation setting them free would compel Southern soldiers to stay at home and protect their plantations, thus weakening their cause. The year was 1861, and Fremont asserted that the issuance of such a proclamation would end the war in a month. And so on the 30th of August in 1861, he issued his proclamation of emancipation, freeing all slaves in Missouri and placing the state under martial law. And then came a communication from President Lincoln, pointing out the weaknesses in his act and requesting modification of the proclamation. Fremont refused to accept the request, which was tantamount to an order, and President Lincoln replied by officially modifying the order. And then Fremont sent his wife to Washington with a letter petitioning the support of the president. But for once, Jessie failed. And in her anxiety, she lost all sense of proportion, going so far as to threaten that if Mr. Lincoln did not support Fremont, her husband would act independently. There were other complications. Fremont had won the enmity of officers acting under the president's orders, and he was accused of insubordination, and he was accused for the second time in his army career of mutiny. And finally, 3 years before he was to issue his own proclamation of emancipation, President Lincoln relieved John Fremont of his command. He returned to Washington, and a storm swept the country, for there were many who knew the courage, the fearless determination, and the high idealism of John Charles Fremont. And then came 1864, another presidential election year, and the Republican Party was torn. The war was going strongly against the North, and political factions were deriding Lincoln, and there was a cry for a third party, a progressive Republican Party. John Fremont was drafted to lead that fight, and once again his name was in line for nomination as President of the United States. But when the Republican convention did meet, Lincoln again swept the meeting. The third party demanded that Fremont lead them in a fight against the president, but motivated by that same instinct of loyalty and decency that had carried him to heights and sometimes to the depths, John Fremont refused and withdrew his name. During the war, a constant stream of gold had poured out of the Mariposa, and John Fremont had become a multimillionaire. But after the war, he turned his enthusiasm to the building of railroads. He floated great loans to build the Memphis and El Paso Railroad, but that venture was a failure, finally ending in bankruptcy. And in 1869, John Fremont again found himself penniless. Moving to a small cottage, the aging general and his still lovely wife eked out a meager existence. And in a feverish endeavor to raise funds, Fremont set to the task of writing the story of his expeditions. But his health failed, and the doctors prescribed a long rest in a warm climate, for the alternative was death. They found a simple, modest cottage in Los Angeles. And there, in the sunshine, Fremont struggled for health and dreamed of the days when gold had poured to his feet from the hills of the Sierra. But he couldn't take defeat easily. He was still the general. He still had world affairs to consider. And there was need of his going to Washington to petition Congress to pay him for the property that the Army had condemned for military use during the war and for which it had never compensated the general. Finally, money was found for railroad fare, and he went east. The year was 1889. In April of 1890, Congress, in view of his services to his country as explorer and soldier, restored him to the Army as Major General retired on an income of $6,000 a year. And now he was rich once again, He and Jesse could live long years of comfort. Oh, he was growing old, and Jesse was not so young. But certainly their troubles now were over. They could sit in the California sun, a strangely different California than they had known when Jesse had first come to San Francisco 40 years before. But it was a better place now, a saner, finer place, and they would enjoy their remaining years together. Thus, Fremont wrote happy and enthusiastic letters to Jesse. He'd be with her soon now. Their troubles were at an end. And then 3 months later, almost alone in a drab New York boarding house, John Charles Fremont died. Out in California, Jessie Benton Fremont lived on. Lived a dozen years, a great lady, honored by all the notables who traveled to the West. Presidents, statesmen, great industrialists came to her modest cottage to kiss her hand, to bow before her, and to speak of the memory of her fabulous, impulsive, adventuring husband. But none of them could eulogize John Charles Fremont more fittingly than did his wife in the simple words with which she wrote finis to the story of his life. From the ashes of his campfires have sprung cities. Did you know that to a careful observer, your eyes can give you away emotionally? A man's reaction to a good-looking woman, and vice versa, can be measured by the widening of the eye's pupil. And so can your amount of interest in many other things. Chinese jade dealers have been aware of that for centuries. When showing a prospective buyer several pieces of jade, the merchant may watch the customer's eyes carefully. If the pupil enlarges when gazing at one particular jade piece, then the price of it is set accordingly. Subtle, but valid. Equally as subtle, too, are other changes in the eye, such as failing sight. Because changes in visual acuity occur so gradually, you may not even be aware that you aren't seeing as well as you should. The size of your pupil is no indication of how good your vision is, of course, but a professional eye examination is. Remember, look to your medical eye doctor for the best in eye care. Look to Jenkel Davidson for the best in eyewear. You have been the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for the San Francisco story. The men and women of Jenkel Davidson hope that you have enjoyed today's program and that you will join us again next week at 9:05 when we shall tell the intimate story of one of San Francisco's great ladies, Ina Coolbrith. Some of these stories are to be found in Samuel Dixon's book Tales of San Francisco, on sale at all bookstores. And this is Bud Heide speaking for the Jenkel Davidson Optical Company with offices throughout Northern California.
Radio 68, KNBR, AM and FM, San Francisco. The United Negro College Fund helps young people from the most impoverished, disadvantaged families in the country in their quest for an education. This distinguished organization deserves your support. Send your contribution today to the United Negro College Fund, Box 3639, San Francisco. Time, 9:30.